Hi, this is Justice Radio. My name is Anna Noriega. I've been working at Colby College Library for about 10 years, and I was honored to be a walk-along for the Justice Think Tank project.
And I am Nazlı Konya, a Colby College faculty and another walk-along. This episode, we would like to focus on the work of our colleagues in the Justice Think Tank. Justice Think Tank is a collaborative research initiative composed of 12 incarcerated scholars researching and advocating for transformative alternatives to the criminal legal system. We are talking today with two members of the Think Tank, Victoria Scott and Lali. So Tori and Lali, would you tell us what the Justice Think Tank is and what you did as fellows? What impact did other fellows have on your work and on your thought process? How was it like to work in a team?
Thanks, Nazlı. That's an excellent question. You did such a great job describing the Justice Think Tank and what it is. To elaborate on your answer, the Justice Think Tank is a multidisciplinary cohort of justice-impacted scholars, most of us being incarcerated or formerly incarcerated, that was founded by Catherine Besteman after she did a tour of a European prison, I think it was in Britain, and saw that they had a think tank that was structured around a similar model. Through a competitive application process, she initiated that through Colby College and within the Maine DOC so that she could gather fellows from different disciplines and different university systems at different levels with diverse backgrounds to be able to question how to implement transformative systems within Maine in the Maine justice system to make it more just. That's kind of some background on that. And as fellows, we used our experiential expertise and the stories that we're aware of our peers to inform the decision-making process and identifying problems that we wanted to solve and to address. So with that expertise, we really hinged our solutions on what we were aware of and how things could be done better based on our knowledge of where the shortcomings in the system. The impact that the other fellows have had on my work and my thought process is really just there are so many things. My teammates and my fellows have challenged me, have reflected a lot of things back to me. They've expanded my awareness and their areas of expertise and helped me figure out how to bridge the gap between my knowledge and my area of expertise and theirs. So working in this team was extraordinarily productive, and I felt like we kind of invented our own political language of the people to be able to discuss amongst ourselves these issues and to come up with viable solutions that could plausibly be implemented in the main political landscape. What do you think, Lali?
I second everything you said, and thank you for touching on the what the think tank was in depth. It was really, I think it was an amazing project for me. It was an eye-opener, and I heard the word think tank before, but I really didn't know exactly what it was, and to be part of it, it was really a gift and an experience. For us, the project we worked on my end was implementing our emerging adults diversion in Maine. And what we thought was really interesting topic, because this project was fun, because the first thing that comes to mind, because all of us that was part of that group that was working on this project, I won't say all, but literally I think all of us but one has experienced incarceration at that time of, you know, emerging adults, which is, this is still a research trying to define what that is. Some would say the age is from 18 to 39. Some would say the age is from 24 to 26. But the one we focus on, the main emerging adults diversion program, we target the ages from 18 to 29. Even in that age, most of us literally experienced it. So that has kind of motivated us, got us in depth to the project that we worked on. As for the impact of what my other fellows have on my work and thought process on the work we did, it was really amazing to experience a group work, even though all of us have some kind of professional or personal relationships outside of the think tank. It was really to put the hat on, you know, and to put that project to learn from each other, be willing to be vulnerable and say, hey, I'm stuck on here. Could you help me on that? Or could you give me feedback on this and piggyback on each other? Great example. One example I can think of that was when we was picking what areas in Maine should we focus on to do the research, right? Because Maine is broad. To kind of say, voice saying that coming to that agreement, let's focus on, you know, Cumberland County area, you know, and let's focus on this upper part, north of Maine, to get that connect, to find the, you know, broader sense of what is needed. And that was really, I was the one who was saying, let's do a Cumberland County, not because I not only because I'm from that area, because I also thought, you know, majority of my community is from that and they've been impacted by the system. And with the research I later on showing, you know, despair release. Yeah, that had, and to develop that sense of being a co-worker together, coming up together in decision-making in those areas was really impactful for me.
Well, thank you for explaining us how you came to choose your topics. Would you like to elaborate a little bit more on also the kind of methodologies you used? Whom did you talk to? You know, what did you do as part of this research process, and what you learned and what you published on during this year of research and advocacy?
Sure. For my group, which was the Maine Criminal Code and Transformative Restorative Reentry Group, we really wanted to identify leaders in the field who were applying innovative approaches, but also lawmakers and criminal legal systems actors in Maine. So we spoke with the District 6 attorney, the prosecutor, to discuss what would viable alternatives look like and what the political climate is, what it has an appetite for, and how it could be, how we could push boundaries just a little bit in order to implement some non-reformist reforms and to seek developments and evolution in that arena. We spoke with senators and representatives. We spoke with the executive director of the Other Side Academy regarding adult alternative sentencing programs that might be able to be piloted within the state. And I think that honestly, it was an interesting moment to have some of our lawmakers tell us that they were learning more from the interview, the information that we shared in the interview with them, then we were learning from them. It was eye-opening and it was really humbling and wonderful to have them be so open and receptive and curious and willing to learn about that. How about you, Law? You also, your group also interviewed the District 6 prosecutor, didn't you?
Yeah, we definitely, yeah, we did. Thank you. We interviewed District 6 prosecutor and we also interview another district attorney from Cumberland County district attorney. We also interview her. We also interviewed on the topic of interviews, we interviewed also those individuals that work in restorative justice organizations, both within Cumberland County, who do this work in the level that they already experience, you know, to check, to get the in depth of what is possible, right? Focusing on what already exists that we can build on it, right? And that I point was like, you know, our goal was to finding the like stakeholders. We don't have to create something that need to just, we don't have to create something new, right? We already have, we have the formula in a small scale. So how we can enlarge in that, right? So relying on the knowledge and the experience, both from the law side, you know, the district attorneys, and also for the community members who are doing the work and already starting that diversion program for the youth. So how can you expand that to the adults? How you can expand the types of crimes, right? That has been, how can you, how do we expand that? So that's what we did. And as for research, we rely on the existing resources, you know, the methods we use with quantitative research. We also did a little research reviews. And one of the, actually that really touched on that we found was a publication that was done by Place Matter at the Cutler Institute at the USM. So that was really, those existence had made it for us that what we found at the end, it was like, it's literally the reason we needed it already existed. So it was more like build on it, expand it, the need of it, bringing that forefront.
What was the name of the place at USM, Lonnie?
Place Matter.
Place within, Matters?
Yeah, within Cutler, Cutler Institute.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a follow-up question for either or both of you who want to answer. It sounds like, and I just was there, so I know this is true, but I wonder if you could help me unpack it. Sounds like this was the kind of project where you led the research, right? The walk-alongs were that, but you all kind of decided what you wanted to do and how. Can you talk to me a little bit, or tell the audience, I guess, the process for choosing who to interview? Because I think when people think of people who are incarcerated, the last thing they think is like, oh, they're going to be conducting interviews with people. But it does happen with people who do news work and that kind of thing. So I don't know if either one of you want to talk about how you decided on who, or you wanted us to try to coordinate for you and that kind of thing.
You want to go first?
I was going to say, take it away, Law. Go ahead. You're on a roll.
I'll give a shot. I definitely think the walk-alongs was really, it wasn't a walk-along. I would call it like a hold-along in a sense, you know? They're like almost like, I don't know if that even makes sense or that's even a word, but it was really, the walk-alongs were the resource for us, right? You know, as you know, majority of us, I think great percentage that was well already incarcerated, right? And, you know, to reaching out, right? You know, and also leaning on their expertise, you know, the walk-alongs had their own experience of research, publication, and things in that nature. So leaning on that, right? You know, and not only that, even though we picked the topics, then understanding that, hey, this is what we're doing, right? You know, feeding back of each other, right? As peers, working together, then also when we come to the conclusion within our peers, then leaning on the walk-alongs, not ideas, but resource and also advice on that, you know? And I do not believe we wouldn't be in that much. It would not be not much, but it would not be so successful, the project we did, if it wasn't for the walk-alongs. And I mean, you can even think about like working with administrations, right? Things come up in prison, right? Like one day things are going one way and the next day, whoop, things have changed. So, you know, that's when the walk-alongs come in. Hey, this is happening. How do we can arrange this? And so it really has been, I think I'm going to reward my whole alone. I would say they were part of the spine of the whole project. So.
Do I have time to tack a little something on to the back of his answer, Anna? All right. As wonderful as our faculty walk-alongs were in helping us to coordinate and make these connections and to do a lot of the outreach that we might not have been capable of doing, and acting as that conduit to be able to connect us with the people that we needed to interview or the resources we needed to be able to access, I really have to just applaud the impressive nature of my colleagues' previous work. We had such a phenomenal cohort of tremendously driven and motivated and self-actualizing scholars here. And I do mean, because the resumes on my peers here are so fantastic. It's amazing. Yes. What kind of work they've engaged in and Yes. The professional networks that they've been able to establish even from behind prison walls. So
Yes. A
lot of our identification process or our directive research was because of the high level of ambition and motivation and passion
that drives
the fellows. So that's how, you know, for instance, we were already aware of Natasha Irving due to a lot of my colleagues' work in restorative justice and due to our own legislative advocacy efforts where we'd come into contact with her and knew that she would at least hear us out.
Yep.
And the fact that Maine is one of only two states in the continental U.S. that allows incarcerated people to remain enfranchised and keeps their voting rights meant that reaching out to lawmakers seemed very natural and like a no-brainer, because it's not often done, but it is our right. So I think that we were all very empowered to exercise that.
Yes. And I was going to say that too, Tori, if you didn't. I don't know that we were more than walk-alongs, but it was so much fun. And I just wanted to hear about your process, because I think for the audience, they might not understand like how, or outside of Maine especially, how this would work. But I think we have to take a short pause. So yes, let's take a little quick break.
You are listening to Justice Radio with Nazlı Konya and Anna Noriega and Lali and Victoria Scott. We are discussing the work of the Justice Think Tank. Anna, I think you had some questions. Remain.
Yeah, I do. Thank you. This is so, I'm sad that we only have half an hour together today, but my next question, or our next question for you both as fellows, we wondered if you could talk about some of the obstacles you encountered along the way, in particular during the research process. You can take that in any direction you'd like.
Do you want to go, Lali, or you want to follow?
Yeah, I'll follow you.
Okay. From my perspective, some of the obstacles that we faced were some of the initial nuts and bolts stuff, being able to organize what sort of permissions we had, making sure that those were solid, and then having to confirm and check in and reconfirm to make sure that those permissions were always consistently valid, being able to be patient enough to wait on requests that we had to make throughout the process to receive advance permissions for things like having a Colby Library account and having to do that through the school. Obviously, we had to make sure it was legal before we engaged in that kind of research work. And our walk-alongs were instrumental in that process. Sometimes it's just the hitches of, you know, people being transferred or moved or having the incidents that happen in prison that impact people's ability to participate, which may diminish numbers of a cohort, which happens sometimes for better or worse. Sometimes you can't really account for what the whole story is on that, but you kind of have to keep soldiering on and just cling to each other even tighter to maintain that strong bond and core group of support. And I think, you know, the transitionality in that was huge. We had a couple of members who had either recently released or who were in their reentry process. And that really impacted their ability to be able to participate in the way they might have wanted, because life is very overwhelming on the other side of the gate, especially when you have to reacquaint yourself with a world that's now unfamiliar. And you're used to being in a controlled environment and you kind of have to fend for yourself once you're freed, you know? So I think that that was a big difficulty, but it also allowed that particular member to speak to their experience when he gave one of our presentations. And the students that were in that auditorium for that presentation were so touched and so moved by that experience, the self-consciousness of feeling stigma and of wanting to engage in this work, but having a difficult time adjusting to life and to being a citizen, you know, again, after being a resident or an inmate of a correctional facility. And I think that it did empower the story because it created that embodied data element. You know, you can see facts and figures, but it's another thing to associate that statistic with a person, a living, breathing person who has this textured story that's evocative and impactful, and they share it with you when you're in the same room.
Thank you, Tori. That's why I want to follow, because you do good. You make my talking easy. As challenging, I second the challenges that Victoria has named it. You know, like you heard New York Minute, you know, that term, but it's a prison minute as well. You know, things can change, right? One time you're in a whole group, next thing you know, something can happen and can impact the whole group. But that was a challenge. It was those challenges that existed. It was also that when we pick ourselves up, right? Like, hey, you know, so-and-so cannot be at this time. You know, who can do this, who can do that, right? That was, and also scheduling was, I think, another challenge. And it wasn't scheduling, getting, you know, even the people who were the interviewees, you know what I mean? They have professions, they have 100 things they do. And also those of us incarcerated, even though, you know, a lot of people think that just because we're in prison, we have all the time in our hands. But those of us in the fellows, that was the opposite, right? Like, even our work, because we busy throughout the day, we had to meet at night, you know, like doing, hey, can we meet at 9 o'clock tonight? Can we do at 10 at night, you know? And some people are like, what are you doing all day? Because we all involved in so many different things, you know, other fellowships, other programs, full-time students, prison, in-house prison jobs, in-house prison, you know, programs, all these other things. So, you know, like working at late nights, like there was nights that we were on Zoom until 11, past 11, right? Doing a co-work, right? And we also gifted that way in Maine, be able to do that, right? Like other prisons, you know, you wouldn't hurt in other prisons, but, you know, we are gifted to do that. Like, hey, I'm, you know, and that has been some of the challenge I can think of has been the scheduling, you know, and unexpected prison minutes. Yeah, I guess I'm going to call a new term, call it prison minutes. So, yeah.
Yes, there were a couple of times where there was a roll call during one of our meetings as a surprise. There were a couple of things that happened with the tech issues on our side. And I don't know, I think there was a storm somewhere in there, but yes. Just seeing everyone kind of, like you said, Lolly, just piece it together with like whoever's there. What an amazing, amazing teams.
And also when I had that walk-alongs, I always had jumped in, you know, the quick communication. Hey, this happened. We're going to do this. Then, you know, walk-alongs was like, how can we help? Who need to contact? How can we do this? Well, we can pick it up. So that also lessened the challenge. Yeah.
Yeah, you go, Nasla. You go.
It made it so easy for us to support you when you were, you know, operating in such a self-directed and motivated manner. you know, the fact that people were up to meeting at 11 p.m. to just, you know, rehearse the next day's presentation, we didn't need to do much other than, you know, offering support and encouragement, basically. It's really fascinating to remember late night rehearsals, and your presentations at the end of the day were ultimately fabulous.
Yes, I was in the audience there at the conference for higher ed in prison, and people were floored. It was just, I mean, at Colby too, it wasn't just the students, which, I mean, that's a lot and that's important, but it was also the faculty who had no idea, like how...
No idea.
The scholarly work that you were not only capable of, but you brought, the game that you brought, it was amazing. So yes, kudos to you all. Did you have anything else you wanted to add about the difficulty or obstacles that you encountered?
I was still looking back. Tori, Victoria, you can add to it. I think looking back, you made us better scholars than we would have been. The challenges we faced, I think it developed. And I also want people to know that working at 11 at night and staying up early in the morning, that's still happening in other projects nowadays. But yeah, yes, yeah. I think it prepared for us, and it made us better scholars to deal with challenges and, you know, come together. And also, you will, any group work, you will have disagreements. But what made us different was that we understood with disagreements and we want to reach a solution, right? It wasn't like disagreements, I'm done, I'm not doing this. Like, okay, let's get this. We will disagree, all right, how are we going to move it? How are we going to do this? You know, and that was another big part, so.
And that was a part of the new political language, I think Tori was referring to, right? Finding a way to agree on things. I think we have time for one last question. If you can maybe spend a couple of minutes to tell us about, you know, what your hopes are moving from here. We know that the work done by the Justice Think Tank has received interest from public officials, including district attorneys and state lawmakers, whom you also interviewed. What do you hope will be the end result of that attention?
I suppose world peace would be too much to ask for. So we'll settle for significant transformation. Action, I think, is the result that I'm hoping we'll achieve, is actual implementation of these recommendations. But I think also the result is exactly, you know, what Anna and Nazli had just mentioned, is that people are floored. They're kind of shook that incarcerated scholars are coming in such an interdependent way to present cohesive, pragmatic, abolitionist and incrementalist reform plans and models that are so well fleshed out, that are so detailed and have all aspects accounted for, because there is such a diversity of political perspective. We had members ranging from anarcho-communist to, you know, liberal to conservative and moderates in between, you know, that we had a little bit of every flavor. And it was not about what our affiliation was and how we identified politically so much as how can what we understand about our positionality go into this melting pot to create a full picture that we can present as constructive feedback for a broken system. So ideally, I hope that this causes people to reevaluate who they believe can participate in the production of knowledge, who is an expert of what, particularly when people have lived through these experiences and they're offering just very keenly crafted solutions to that. And they're willing to collaborate and sit down at a table with people who might have previously positioned themselves in kind of an adversarial role, because the system affects all of us. And I think it's that understanding that made us so solution oriented, but also willing to take some incremental chances so that we could have this non-reformist reform and pragmatic approach to be able to build trust with the public. So I hope that this has certainly built trust between lawmakers and attorneys and the public and incarcerated scholars, so that they see us for more than they saw on the news and more than what they thought we were. And they know that we don't know our full story because the rest is still unwritten. And we're hoping to be able to write a happy ending here together and hopefully have a brighter future for all involved.
I second everything Victoria said and everything the work represents, right? And in the first step, I think we got it. We wanted to be, it was to show people, right? hey, this is possible. It's coming from lived experience, who lived through these systems, right? As I mentioned earlier, that, you know, some of us got into the system at a really, really young age, right? And understand what it is, right? And what is need to be done. I also want to thank you, Victoria, for bringing it up. The diverse of the work, right? Like protocol views of all of us, right? Backgrounds, you know, and it is really, and I remember one of our reporters, the group I was part of, one of our advice was like, when you're making a work, don't make protocol size, right? Justice has no protocol steps, right? It doesn't have no race. Justice is like doing what is right, right? So we thought these projects was what is right. And now that, you know, hearing some of our other fellows testifying at the State House, right, because the work we've done here. When you, you know, when we get random emails, so I'm like, hey, we've done this work. We're trying to figure out and implement these, some of the things you guys suggested, right? So that's what we wanted to start the conversation, right? And everything started with conversation. And I think if we all listen to each other, it doesn't matter whether you're the district attorney, the cop, the teacher, the bus driver, whoever you are. I think if we listen to each other, we can solve our issues, right? And that's what was our goal. And we hope that's what I hope that could happen, that bus driver can read it and he can talk to his state senator, can talk to the professor, talk to the district attorney, a judge can read it and see that the diverse of the work that we produced can also bring diverse way we can see justice and, you know, understand the harms that our system's done to us as communities and also learn from those of us who was part of the harm, right? And when I say part of the harm, we mean harming us and also causing harm in ourselves, right?
Thank you so much, both of you.
Yes, thank you so, so much. I wish we had more time, but we don't. Just want to say thank you to both of you for repping still. And I hope you're not doing too many 11 o'clock nights, but the show can link to the papers that you did. So we'll make sure that those are linked so people can read up, including the bus drivers.
While they're driving, though.
Not while you're driving. Thank you, Tori. Ever the conscientious, one of the group. Thank you. As we wrap up, my heart goes out to both of you and thanks. And I wish you all the best as you go into this new season. And I want to also say thanks to the Blues Man for the music that's closing out our show.
Well, we need to say it.
Thanks to the Blues Man, Samuel James, for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, and to Aaron Pyle, our sound engineers. We are Justice Radio.
We might.